Now, joining me in studio is, this could get a little bit confusing, but it's my namesake, Owen McDermott. Hello, Owen McDermott.
Hello, Owen McDermott. How are you?
Oh, turn up your microphone. Hello.
Hello, Owen. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Now, not only is Owen my namesake, Owen is here. Your official title is your head of training with the Communications Clinic. You're a career guru.
I am indeed. Little did we think we would be sharing a studio together when we were in college, 10 years ago, sharing Irish notes and our politics notes, I think.
So not only is Owen my namesake, we were in the same class in UCD in politics and in Irish.
I was Owen T. McDermott, actually, which was the most depressing thing on my first day in UCD, where I didn't realise, and I realised then, that I was not the only one. There was another one around who happened to spell their name exactly the same way as me.
Does that mean I registered my name first?
You got in there ahead of me. I think you might have been that bit older, so I was Owen T.
Well, wait, when's your date of birth?
1st of the 3rd, 83?
15th of the 4th, 83.
Oh, so they didn't do it that way.
No, I didn't do it. I think I was just in first. I was a more eager student. But obviously not really, because I suppose now this is like a sliding doors moment. This is how our lives could have gone. You went on and got a real career, and then I moved to New York to be a dancer, and that didn't work out, so I tried media. But
well,
here we are.
It's worked out here. You are in Ryan Tuberty's slot, and it's wonderful.
Yeah, well, here we are in the hot seat. So listen, you are here to talk about, I suppose, like I say, you're the director and head of training with the Communications Clinic. And I suppose now it's the dawn of a new era for a lot of people starting colleges. And this is the time a lot of people maybe consider a career change, because it's just post-summer vibes and whatnot. And they've done a little bit of pondering over the summer months. So let's start now with people who've just maybe received their Leaving Cert results. If they didn't get the points or the college course they were after, where do they go from here? What's the next move for them?
Well, I think there's probably tons of us who haven't gotten or didn't get what we wanted in our Leaving Cert results. And I think the rule of thumb is don't panic, because there's probably options out there. Quite an unpalatable one for me would be the idea of having to go back and do the Leaving Cert, which was the kind of most horrible exam I could ever think of. But if there is a course that you didn't get and you really, really wanted it, and you're going to be really, really sad that you didn't get it, I'd say, well, look, there's a very clear option, which is go back and repeat the Leaving. However, yeah, a lot of people mightn't want to do that. There are other options then, for example, that if you can have box clever on your CAO, there may be other avenues into the course you wanted. If I can give you an example, I met a girl a couple of years ago who wanted to do multimedia in DCU, didn't get the points, missed it by 40, quite a high points course, and didn't get it in the second round. But herself and her career guidance counsellor had boxed clever on the CAO and discovered that there was a course in Kalasha Dulig, which was kind of what they would refer to as a FETAC feeder, which meant if you could actually pass a series and get a series of scores in that course, you would feed into DCU. So they kind of went that way, and that worked really, really well. However, you might find, if you've selected your CAO quite well, that your second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth choice are actually quite interesting. And don't necessarily think that your course that you have chosen or the course that you end up studying is what's going to impact on your career, because often it doesn't. There was an accountancy firm I was working with during the summer who have had grads coming in from a wide range of what you would think actually had to be accountancy, when in fact, on that group of about 100 that they brought in, someone had studied botany in UCG, had studied film studies in Trinity, and somebody had studied communications in DCU. Now, when you're
looking for accounting,
so when you're looking, when they were studying their carnations and their roses in Galway, I don't think they had planned on being an accountant a couple of years later. But in
fact, film studies.
Yeah, it was. Those are the types of things. And what the accountancy firm said to me was, well, look, they had done okay in maths, they had done okay in accountancy in their Leaving Cert. Yeah, they had studied something differently, but they were quite confident they'd be able to pass the Chartered Accountants exams, so they didn't really mind.
And is that like me looking at Suits or Ally McBeal going, I could definitely be a lawyer, man, no problem.
Well, for law, for example, yeah, you could if you did a master's. There are ones that I would say, okay, what you studied, of course, impacts on what you did. So I'd kind of call them the life or death ones. If you're cutting me open, I'd like to know you've studied medicine. If you're going in to give me a filling, you kind of have to have done dentistry. Or if I'm going to let you at my dog, okay, I want you to have done veterinary. But those are the kind of life and death ones. For other ones, maybe like law or maybe like accountancy, you actually don't necessarily have had to have studied it. You just have to be able to show a competence to be able to do it later on.
A lot of people aren't. I wasn't aware of that at all. I thought if you want to be an accountant, you have to do accountancy.
Yeah, there's accountancy exams that happen. So the ACCA, then there's the tax ones. But once you have a kind of a basic level of about a 2-1, for a lot of the big four, which would be kind of the KPMGs, the Ernst & Youngs, the Deloittes, they actually would look at you as a kind of a wider person, not solely on your degree, but more importantly, what did you achieve in that? So 2-1 upwards.
Okay. Excellent.
Yeah, so there's options. People shouldn't panic rather than saying, gosh, yeah, of course, if you chose something and you didn't get it, there will be an initial thing of, I didn't get what I wanted, and it might feel like a crisis. But like in most crises, there are options and ways of doing it, and it's not rushing into things. It's having a quick think, and then it's being able to go on and see what the world and what, where it takes you.
Yeah. And in terms of internships, because internships pertain to academic stuff and also more practical skills as well. But one of the big things proffered about internships sometimes by particular people is that they're exploitative and people are working really long hours and they're not getting paid. And obviously the flip side to that is, oh, you're getting experience. But what do you find is the level of kind of sincere, genuine, applicable experience versus companies just trying to get some free labour?
Well, totally. It can be totally exploitative if somebody chooses a wrong organisation, that people will actually take advantage of. That is a risk. However, I think internships or work experience are completely useful and beneficial if the candidate or if the person going to them has a focus on what they're trying to achieve. So a lot of them, from my experience, have actually been sincere, practicable and useful. For example, again, one of the accountancy firms that I would know very clearly, they would have quite demanding internships, but 80% of their interns get a contract with them for 3 years. So there is a very clear benefit. But I happened to be chatting to a guy during the summer, and I said, asking about what he had done in his internship, and he had gone to a law firm. I said, how did you find it? He said, I absolutely hated it. It was the best summer I had ever spent. And I thought that was kind of counterintuitive and didn't really make sense. But he had thought he wanted to be a corporate lawyer, got an internship, and actually then realised, this isn't for me. I never want to work in this area, and didn't view it as a waste. So often, yes, it can lead directly to a job, but it can also provide clarity for somebody there who actually says, no, this isn't for me. Then an internship, if you box clever and you think carefully about it, can give you access to organisations that could give you a job that you wouldn't have had an opportunity to have before. If you look, people often think, I want to go for a Facebook or a Google or work in these big, kind of big. Yeah. But getting in there is incredibly difficult. They're bureaucratic. They have systems not actually to get you in, that create barriers to it. Whereas advice I'd give to someone if they're looking at it, Enterprise Ireland, for example, have a list of all of the startups, SMEs that they are supporting. Hundreds of companies. I'd be going to them and applying to them to say, could I do an internship? Because you're probably working in a small company. You have access to the boss. They get a chance to see you doing good stuff. And there is a need potentially for you to go through. So people often try and jump high and say, well, let's go for a Facebook. When actually some of the smaller organisations are probably the best place to go.
And so do you think if someone's in doing an internship, maybe they've realised that they're the whipping boy, or they're only there to make the tea, or indeed girl, should they stick it out? Because it probably looks good on the CV, even if you're having a miserable time. It's good to have, isn't it, down the line for some unforeseen happening.
Well, it's great to have something to put on a CV. It's great experience. But there is also, an expectation that there will be a little bit of tea making. Like, I remember hearing in an organisation I worked with where one of the interns had wrapped up and could say at the end, I'm proud to say I never made a cup of tea in my time there. Now, that didn't necessarily enamour him or put people thinking he was a wonderful fella. There were jobs there, but he wasn't buying in, he wasn't actually getting stuck in. And part of getting stuck in an internship is actually, yes, going making the tea. Hopefully there will be more practical or more interesting pieces of work to get into, but you also have to suck it up a little bit and not view making tea as exploitation.
Well, the only reason I got this job covering for Ryan is because I let him whip me occasionally, but it's okay. I'm happy
and
to
make
take
the tea.
It. And I make wonderful tea as well, so that's good. Now, listen, CVs, because a lot of people now, maybe they didn't get the course they wanted and say, oh, I'm going to take a year off, or I'm hearing a lot of stuff. You know, this big accommodation crisis, all these students having, particularly country students, having to surrender courses in Dublin because they can't find somewhere to stay. So if they've done that, maybe, or whatever, deferring a course for a year and they're going to go get a job, and they want maybe something, you know, more than a minimum wage kind of job. What's the best way to maximise your CV without having amazing experience so far?
Well, CVs haven't changed a whole lot over the years. So you'll find wonderful resumes or wonderful kind of examples or templates on the internet. And they haven't really changed because pretty much what it is a chronology of what you have done, telling people about the kind of skills you would develop. What I'd be advising somebody who is looking for a role would be that you keep it skills-based, as in, here are the skills I have, but also the skills you need, and achievements-based. So here are some of the things I would have done, whether it's something you would have done in school, in college, or charity work, for example, or work experience, to keep it achievements-focused. But as I said, it haven't really changed. The first kind of review, and I found this quite interesting, the first resume that is reported was Da Vinci. 1480s, back in about 1483, 1484, that it was thought that he was the first person to write one, and it was to the Duke of Milan for military expertise. He was looking for it, and before Da Vinci wrote or painted the Last Supper or sculpted his wonderful pieces of art, he was a military engineer, and he wrote a 10-point resume, well, kind of more of a cover letter, saying, here's what you need and here's what I can do. So it was things like cannons, bridges, tanks. It was fascinating, and if someone wants to see it, they can Google Da Vinci resume and it'll have it up there. But it didn't really, and it hasn't really changed in 600 years of how to piece together a good CV or a good cover letter. It's here's what you need, here's what I've got, and here are a couple of examples of that. So if someone's thinking about it, I think a cover letter is probably the way to go, as well as the CV, because it gives you an opportunity to talk in a way that you couldn't do with a CV. Like, you're able to say what I think is makes the company special, organisation special, some of the needs that they might have. So if I can actually give you another piece, though, of advice a little bit, you need to be careful about who's CC'd in on the email that you're getting. A friend of mine's a hiring manager with one of a marketing company and PR company in Dublin. He received in application, and I'll paraphrase the first line, but it was something along the lines of, I view your company as the most special and leading marketing company in Ireland. And then he saw all of his competitors CC'd in on the email as well. And the poor applicant had actually sent it to all of the PR and marketing companies in Dublin, not just him. So it didn't really make him feel warm and fuzzy and special. In fact, it was just as an example of making a mistake.
He deserves to make the tea, that guy. Now, you know the way you've sat on interview boards, I assume, for jobs. And
I have indeed.
Many different walks of careers and stuff. Is it true that, you know, the initial impression thing, do people lose it in the first minute, regardless of their qualifications on, I don't know, presentation or that kind of thing?
They can, of course. There is an interesting book by a guy called Malcolm Gladwell, who has written a book called Blink. He also wrote Tipping Point and Outliers. But pretty much he says that we thin slice and we have an ability to make calls almost immediately, based on a whole series of experiences we may have had. So physicalities, the look and feel. And so, yes, that can impact on them. He gives actually an example of tryouts for orchestras, where they now do the tryout behind a curtain or a screen, so that the people assessing it just have to listen, where they don't make decisions on race or gender or dress or anything like that, and because they just need to hear the music and how it's played. That can't really happen in job interviews. So candidates just probably need to be aware that, yes, how they dress, not that dress is the be-all and end-all, but they need to kind of turn up clean, kind of with a well-ironed shirt.
Basic sanitation.
All of, you know, hair brushed to a certain point. All of those types of things, yes, are important. And then remembering that hitting the ground running in an interview is absolutely important. That people begin to make an impression on how prepared you are, how enthusiastic you are, and thinking through, well, what are the first things I'd like to say to somebody in an interview? And often the first question is, tell me a little bit about yourself. And that's a question that's very preparable for. But really what an interview panel are looking for is more so, tell me about what you can do for me and what you have to offer for the job. And so, yes, people do make quick decisions. Interview panels themselves need to be aware that often they can make the wrong snap decision, but that people can influence it by how well they answer the first question, and then also wearing something that's not going to distract or behaving in a way that would distract a panel as well.
Okay, brilliant. So don't come in with your pants slung around your butt cheeks.
And it's being able to think about the types of odd questions that you could get asked and those kind of things as well, in terms of being able to prepare for an interview. Like, if you look at things like, for example, there's a book, Are You Smart Enough to Work for Google? Which essentially said Google had all of these mad questions. For example, I'll ask you this one, Owen. How many piano tuners are there in the entire world?
I would sit there in stupefied
exactly.
silence.
Exactly, and you should, because these questions had no point, and people began to think, gosh, Google, aren't they fascinating and aren't they very intelligent and psychologically important? And then Google eventually came out and said they're utterly pointless.
Just having a laugh.
Well, there to make the interviewer feel special and strong and intelligent and put the panellists through kind of hell, which is ultimately a waste of time. So people just need to think about the skills or things that are required for the job and where they've done it before.
Owen McDermott, lovely to see you in your parallel universe with your two kids settled down with a wonderful career. That's Owen McDermott there from the Communications Clinic. A pleasure, sir. A pleasure. We're